This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
These are just anecdotes, but it's building up into something more coherent.
And I think it'd be interesting to really try to unravel what his ties.
There's this sort of country-city divide.
They're inconvenient. Ends and it's not clear where it goes next.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
American Sonnet for the New Year, Terrence Hayes. Things got terribly ugly incredibly quickly. Things got ugly embarrassingly quickly, actually. Things got ugly unbelievably quickly, honestly. Things got ugly seemingly infrequently, initially. Things got ugly ironically, usually, awfully, carefully. Things got ugly unsuccessfully, occasionally. Things got ugly mostly painstakingly, quietly, seemingly. Things got ugly beautifully, infrequently. Things got ugly, sadly, especially frequently, unfortunately. Things got ugly increasingly, obviously. Things got ugly suddenly, embarrassingly, forcefully. Things got really ugly regularly, truly, quickly. Things got really incredibly ugly. Things will get less ugly, inevitably, hopefully.
You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Terrence Hayes is a winner of the National Book Award in Poetry, and the poem we just heard, American Sonnet for the New Year, was recently published in the New Yorker. Last year, Hayes published a collection called American Sonnets for My Past and Future Assassin, 70 poems all describing what it feels like to be a black man in America today.
I started writing these sonnets right after the 2016 election, and I was essentially writing one a day just to cope with the noise, the political noise, the cultural noise, America as it stands. This poem predominantly feels a little bit shocked by the shift in, again, the country and what we think the country is. But I do believe that the turn, you know, that always has to happen in the sonnet, that volta is really the last line, perhaps even the last word. So, I mean, I think I was probably around line 10 or 11 and still thinking, I don't know how I'm going to get out of this thing. And, you know, when I came upon inevitably, hopefully, I thought, well, there it is. And so I felt like this was maybe the last one, you know, because something about the end of this year and some shifts in all kinds of ways made me feel like, oh, maybe we're having a turning point here. Maybe something's going to change for the country in this new year. So this is me thinking differently, really, feeling and hoping that something's about to shift here. That would be what would be American about this thing, I think, is always to kind of hope for some better future or some kind of transformation out of even our least attractive positions in the world, I guess.
Terrence Hayes. You can find American Sonnet for the New Year and other works by Hayes at newyorker.com. And this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. There have been a lot of names attached to the rise of Donald Trump. Roy Cohn comes to mind, or Roger Stone, Steve Bannon. But the most influential figure on the 45th president has quite likely been a guy named Mark Burnett. And if you don't know that name, you're probably familiar with his work. Burnett is the English-born TV producer who helped bring reality TV into our lives, producing Survivor, The Voice, Shark Tank, and many other programs, including The Apprentice. It's Burnett's work on The Apprentice that conceivably changed the world. Staff writer Patrick Radden-Keefe recently profiled Mark Burnett, and he wrote in depth about The Apprentice and its impact on Donald Trump, on how America saw Donald Trump, and how Donald Trump saw himself. Patrick, in your piece, you write about a moment in 2016, and Jimmy Kimmel was hosting the Emmys, and this was right before the election. And Kimmel did something which at that time was pretty unorthodox. He called out Mark Burnett, a name most people didn't know, who was sitting in the audience, and he called him out for creating Donald Trump. Here's a clip of that.
Many have asked, who is to blame for Donald Trump, the Donald Trump phenomenon? And I'll tell you who, because he's sitting right there. That's right, that guy. Mark Burnett, the man who brought us Celebrity Apprentice. Thanks to Mark Burnett, we don't have to watch reality shows anymore because we're living in one. Thank you, Mark. I'm going on the record right now. He's responsible. If Donald Trump gets elected and he builds that wall, the first person we're throwing over it is Mark Burnett.
Is Jimmy Kimmel right? Did Mark Burnett create Donald Trump?
I think he is. Look, Trump created Trump. There was a Trump persona that that Donald Trump invented for himself long before the show. But I interviewed a whole bunch of people who worked on The Apprentice over the years. And what they told me was he was kind of a punchline in the tabloids.
He was a kind of joke figure.
He absolutely
was
a
joke. And local.
Yes. And so what the folks who worked on the show said was that was the guy who we found. And our whole job was to reinvent him as this master of the universe who's always riding around Manhattan in helicopters and broadcast that to tens of millions of people across the country.
Now, tell us a little bit about Mark Burnett. He was born in England, was he not?
Yeah, so he grew up in East London watching Bonanza and other American TV shows.
So how did he get into TV himself?
He ends up coming to Los Angeles in the early 80s. And by his own admission, he starts working almost immediately without a green card. And after working a few different jobs.
So just to be clear here, he's an illegal, as they say.
He has certainly in the Trump administration definition. Yeah, Mark Burnett would be, could be sent home today. So he comes out, he starts working various jobs, but eventually finds his way into the very early days of reality TV. And from there, he goes on to have a tremendous success, his first really huge success with the show Survivor.
The winner of the first Survivor competition is Rich. Congratulations, Rich.
So after Survivor, Burnett pitches The Apprentice and he plucks Donald Trump out of the tabloids, puts him on the show, and it all turns out to be incredibly successful for both of them. What was the relationship personally between Burnett and Donald Trump like?
It was fascinating. They were very tight and remain very close to this day. Burnett loves to tell people that one of his two sons was the ring bearer when Trump married Melania at Mar-a-Lago. And it's interesting, though, in those early days, because Burnett is a guy who, to the extent that he had a belief system back then, it seems to have been very shaped by the kind of culture of American self-help.
How do you mean?
And well, the kind of, he really believed, he actually said at one point, there's a few things that Americans really believe in. They'll pay to figure out how to grow hair, they'll pay to have sex, and they'll pay to have somebody tell them how to get rich. And it's this weird thing, which I think he shares with Trump, where he's both kind of really cynical about how gullible Americans are, but also really excited about how you can sell them stuff.
So how did he and the staff around him, how did they go about creating this character on television called Donald Trump?
So you talk to people who worked on the show and they'll say, God, you know, he was such a hustler. When we first got started, we were looking for a studio space where we could have the boardroom, and we propose a place in Chelsea and we propose a place downtown. And Trump keeps vetoing everything. We can't figure out why. And then finally says, well, you know, as it just so happens, I have an empty floor in Trump Tower,
which
I could lease to you at a reasonable rate. And then they agree that they're going to do that and they have to furnish the place. And so this is what they experienced. They told me, we walked through the offices, we saw chipped furniture. You really saw the kind of, you know, somebody described it as kind of an empire in decline at that point. And their whole job was to make it seem slick, to make Trump seem like he was on the ascendant. They would film these very dramatic entrances for him all the time with dramatic music, and he would kind of stride out, and they made him seem very decisive, as though he was a guy with unimpeachable judgment.
One of the things that Trump was known for before The Apprentice was not only how much money he had made, but how much money he had lost, the bankruptcies and all the rest. Now, The Apprentice recasts him as this wildly successful tycoon. How did that affect public perception of Donald Trump? Did it work?
It did, and it really affected it dramatically. If you go back, as I did, to the interviews that Trump did just before The Apprentice and then just after it starts coming out, you see that even he is kind of surprised. I found this quote where he said, this is right after the show aired, he said, you know, people like me now and they think I'm great, whereas before they thought I was a bit of an ogre. Even by his own admission, he had become something of a punchline. So he would tell a story that you know, Page Six in the New York Post, they don't buy that story anymore. But suddenly he's on NBC, on national TV with tens of millions of people, and they bought it.
But it wasn't always so easy. About 13 years ago, I was seriously in trouble. I was billions of dollars in debt. But I fought back, and I won big league. I used my brain. I used my negotiating skills.
You actually spoke to someone who was intimately involved in the production of The Apprentice. Who is he and what did he do?
So I spoke to a guy named Jonathan Braun, who had a long history with Burnett, actually going back as far as Eco Challenge. He'd worked on Survivor, and then he was one of the first people in on The Apprentice. And Braun was the supervising editor over the first six seasons of The Apprentice.
The show was an immediate hit, you know, which supported Trump's ballooned ego, because the numbers were good, not ever as good as he said they were, but they were very good.
So you sign on to The Apprentice at a point where you don't know who the host is going to be, but you know it's a business show. And then you find out the host is Donald Trump. What were your impressions of Trump at the time?
My impression of Donald Trump at the time, and again, this is 2004, 2003, I think, is when we shot it. He had just come out of, I don't know how many bankruptcies. His reputation had sunk quite low. You know, he was known amongst me and my friends and my peers and everybody that I'd talked to as kind of an oddball celebrity for being a loser, for building a tall building but not being able to rent it out.
Tell me, how would you describe the role of an editor in a reality TV show?
The simple answer is that we scour through hours and hours of material that's shot and look for stories that we can relate to the theme of the show. We showed everything that happened the way it happened. But, you know, like anything, you can't show the entire 300 or 400 hours. You have to show the representative portions of it. And, yeah, there are techniques that we use to enhance that. For example, the first day of shooting was individually shooting every contestant leaving as if they've been fired.
Is that right?
So, yeah, the very first thing they shot was people leaving the front of the building with their rolling suitcase in the suit, you know, that they would wear.
They all have to enact their own death before they even get started.
Yeah, because you just didn't know who it was going to be.
Amazing. And can you tell me just a little bit about the ways in which, in terms of the creation of the Trump persona, the things that the show did to make him out to be this master of the universe?
Well, the famous one is that, you know, that he can make decisions, that he can, you know, make sober, thoughtful decisions, you know, that seem like they were actually thought out. But I got to tell you, I don't know that they were. He reacted a lot very instinctually to things. He didn't always make sense. We reversed engineered the show in that, you know, we could never count on Donald making what would seem like a logical choice in who the winner and loser would be. So we would sometimes have to go back after he would choose which one won and which one lost, and we'd have to amp up or accentuate more the basis for that decision.
Right.
We had to kind of present him in the best light possible. You know, editors go through and make sure you take out people's ums, ahs, and false starts and things like that. You do that with people, you know, if they say something dumb. You don't show that part, you know. If majority of what they're saying is pretty smart or fits what the story is, you know, you keep that part and you get rid of the part that doesn't follow that. And I think it's super fascinating and very gratifying and validating is that this is what the White House has to do with Trump. You know, you can watch him any day of the week when he's live in front of a, you know, a press group, and he'll just start rambling on about something. Most of the time, he doesn't even make sense. But he will. But when he does find something he wants to say, he'll say it five or six times over and over again, but slightly differently. And if you hear it all together, unedited, it's like, what? But, you know, when we would cut it down to the salient parts, or when the news media, you know, pulls out a bite or pulls out a clip, you know, it kind of makes sense. I mean, you know, people get behind it.
That's fascinating. So you think, so when you watch him today, you feel as though the news media, weirdly enough, ends up doing exactly what you and your colleagues used to do, which is pulling out the one salient soundbite from the kind of—
Absolutely.
The whole maw of free association.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, look, it's a technique that we all use in whatever communications media we're in. You know, you need to present the most clear argument for something. But somebody who is a good speaker, a good orator, can say it without stumbling, without backing up and reversing himself and saying something crazy. I think that's part of the reason why we have these two completely different ecospheres of people who say, no, what he's saying makes total sense. And other people saying, but what he's saying is completely crazy or is completely wrong or bad. Because you can pull whatever you want from there. You can pull the good one, the one where it sounds like he makes sense, or you can pull the one that, you know, that doesn't.
Yeah. I spoke to you and I spoke to others who were involved in the show.
Yeah.
And a number of people told me, yeah, you know, it was all a little bit tongue-in-cheek. So yeah. I went back and I watched a bunch of episodes.
Right.
And I didn't see it. I didn't see the wink.
Yes. Obviously, it was not something that we overtly did. We didn't parody Donald Trump. So you can't, you know, you can't be, you know, you can sort of sneak a few things in.
Well, can you give an example?
Yeah. I mean, the theme song itself was a kind of disco funk, kind of like New York.
Money, money, money,
yeah.
Money.
And it was, I mean, that in and of itself was funny. I mean, because, you know, the song itself kind of puts down the idea of having a lot of money is going to make you happy. And we would use that kind of music, especially when Donald would show up.
But it's interesting you should mention his entrances because, so, you know, 2015, Trump announces his candidacy for president. And he does it in the atrium at Trump Tower, and he starts out at the top of that gold escalator, and he rides down, actually kind of facing out, and there's all these people standing around watching him. And I wonder, I mean, you've surely seen that footage. Did it remind you of anything?
Absolutely. You know, we use that exact type of footage in the show many times when he would, if he were to assign a task, he would, you know, gather all both teams together and say, okay, here's your task. Your task is going to do this or do that. And his entrances, they were designed, you know, whether it was coming in through closed doors and or coming in on a helicopter, or in this case, you know, if it was done inside the Trump Tower, of him coming down the escalator.
Good morning.
Morning, Mr. Trump.
Morning. We're in the lobby of Trump Tower. It's big. I think big. I want you to think big, too.
That's Jonathan Braun, who is the supervising editor on The Apprentice. We heard a clip of Donald Trump descending the golden escalator in season two of The Apprentice in a shot that's reminiscent, to say the least, of Trump's descent on that escalator when he announced his 2016 campaign. Braun spoke with The New Yorker's Patrick Keefe. Now, Patrick, we tend to think of Hollywood dominated by left-leaning people, liberals. The people who worked on The Apprentice are from that very same world. Did they feel bad about the role they might have played in Trump's rise to power?
Yeah. So the first thing to understand is that the people who were involved with that show, with the big exception of Mark Burnett, tend not to like Donald Trump. They didn't like him when they were making the show.
Why not?
Because he was he could turn on – what I kept hearing was he was somebody who could turn on the charm when he felt as though it behooved him to do so, but was generally not a likable person to work with and was kind of increasingly ridiculous with every passing year. He would often suggest that he was going to run for president. Even when he announced in 2015, all of the people who were involved in The Apprentice at that point privately say, this will play itself out pretty quickly. Donald will be back, to a point where—
Much of the country thought that.
They did, but to a point where they were actively casting the next season of The Apprentice, even as Donald Trump was running for president, because they all felt as though, look, at a certain point, he's going to come back, and then we'll just go right back into business, and we don't want to not have a cast at that stage.
Why didn't Mark Burnett want to talk to you?
That's a good question. He does continue to talk to journalists to promote his shows. He won't answer questions about Trump. And to me, this is really interesting because I think this is a guy who's in a futile race, you know, with his own legacy. He's trying to kind of run away from his own legacy. He doesn't want to address it. He'd rather just keep focusing on the shows. But the reality is, he's still close with Trump. They still talk. He was involved in helping produce the inauguration. And, you know, I think the first line of this guy's obituary is going to be that he helped put Donald Trump into the White House. You can run from that, but I don't think you can hide.
Patrick, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Patrick Radden Keefe is a staff writer, and you can find his article about Mark Burnett and the rise of Donald Trump at NewYorker.com. In a minute, the story of the biggest heist from an art museum in a generation and the very unique character who pulled it off, a burglar who feels that stealing isn't a job or a scam, but a calling.
I saw the burglary of the five paintings in my dreams 15 years earlier. I knew that someday I would do something great.
That's coming up on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In 2010, on a night in May, some $70 million worth of art was stolen from a museum in Paris in one night. For months, the French police couldn't find the thief, and they still haven't found the paintings. It seems like something from a heist movie, but this actually happened, a $70 million theft. And who pulls off something like that? And how? Here's contributor Jake Halpern with the story of the thief known as the Spider-Man of Paris.
it was the screw that gave it away. Viren Tomic was standing in the dark at night in front of a window of the MAM in Paris. That's the Museum of Modern Art. He just used his pocket knife to scrape the paint away so that he could see the screw better, examine just how it bit into the window frame. And it confirmed his hunch. The frame was old-fashioned, just like the window from a job he'd done before. He knew how to take it apart. A few days later, Tomic goes back to the MAM. The galleries are open, and like everyone else, he goes into the front door, buys a ticket, and wanders around. On the walls, there are Picassos, Kandinskys, and some motion detectors that don't seem to be working. He makes a note. The sensors, the paintings, the windows. There's an opportunity here. Tomic has been writing to me for a year from his jail cell in France. An actor is reading from the letters that he wrote to me.
I was a child with a devious tendency, an evil disposition. I did not speak much. I remember myself when I was 7 or 8 years old, and cousins I lived with. I would put cactus spines in their shoes to see how much pain they could stand. I locked a friend my age in an empty barrel. We were playing hide-and-seek. I abandoned him, hoping that nobody would find him.
The press calls him Spider-Man, but he says that's been his nickname since he was a kid, back when he grew up in a Bosnian mountain town, famous for its raging river and tall bridge. Local kids made a sport of climbing the rocks along the riverbank and leaping into the water.
It's a custom for us, like in Acapulco in Mexico. For me, climbing started around the age of 6 or 7.
That's where Tomic climbed to his first robbery. He used a ladder to get to the window of a library about 16 feet up a wall. He stole a few old books. When he was 11, Tomic left Bosnia-Herzegovina for Paris. His family lived in a building that shared a wall with the Père Lachaise Cemetery, where Jim Morrison, Marcel Proust, Edith Piaf, and many others are buried.
There was everything in the cemetery. Black masses at night. Hippies going to Jim Morrison's grave. Hundreds of people came on pilgrimage. There were drugs everywhere. And dealer gangs would fight each other. It was our playground because it was the only thing we had. The cemetery in front of the window.
Tomic had a hard time in Paris. A hard time learning French. And money was tight for the family. His mother was disabled and his father was mean to him. Cold. Tomic often ran away from home. By 12, he started stealing things to get by. He'd break into cars and steal the stereos or rummage around in the glove box. By 14, he and some friends had started breaking into apartments.
My first burglary in Paris. I used the cemetery outer wall to access the yard and climb one of the buildings. I got a gold-plated Dupont lighter with a small bag of jewels and no more than 150 francs. So, did I imagine that I was going to become a famous burglar? Of course.
He got hooked.
It started as a test, like an obsession to do something more. Something was pulling me, encouraging me to do it. Later, I found that there was a double personality in me, a spiritual guide. My ability to sneak into buildings is like a gift. I sometimes think for a while. Then, as if by magic, without the magic wand, I have the formula.
The night after he uncovers the screw in the MAM window, Tomic goes back. He wears a hoodie, and he walks around the outside of the museum very carefully. He has to pick the right window. And there's one just behind a parapet, out of view of the security cameras.
The one on the corner of the façade that allowed me to watch over both sides of the esplanade. Nobody could see me, except for a few passing cars.
Now the museum, it's across the street from the Seine. Tomic finds an inconspicuous spot to sit, and he waits.
I stay there 5 hours to see if an internal or external security check will happen. Inside, a guard shows up around 3 o'clock in the morning. A guard with a dog comes to the street to check the surroundings. So, I am not alone. The museum is not alone.
He watches for another night, just to make sure that he's got the guard's routine down. And once he figures out his window and the schedule, Tomich goes back with supplies. He's got a dark piece of cloth that he hangs like a curtain outside the window to give himself cover.
It is smart, and it allows me to do my job quietly, without being seen.
Tomich sits and works. He uses paint-stripping acid to expose the heads of each screw. Then he applies another solution to remove the rust.
I chose acid with a stripper for the frame paint, a small Dremel tool to remove the plaster where the screws are. It is necessary to sand off and clean everything. 2 hours per night, 6 nights. There is a lot of work to be done.
And always, always, he keeps an eye on his watch. He's a pro. He's been doing this for decades. He's come to believe that his success is part practice, but also part destiny. It's like he feels mystically drawn to the places he robs.
I also have to be in harmony with certain places. Some places pull me. Something is waiting for me. Sometimes it's hard to understand what I feel. So I let myself be guided by my subconscious. The luxury apartment started when I was 17 years old.
His first one is this chic building, and he gets his way up onto the roof and then rappels down the side to the fourth floor to the apartment that he's got his eye on.
The apartment was more than 5,000 square feet. I noticed white sheets on some dressers and furniture. All the works of art were placed on the wooden floor. There were lots of them. It looked like a museum.
Tomich didn't know anything about paintings, and so it didn't occur to him to take them. But he did notice a catalog for an upcoming art auction. And a few weeks later, he went to check it out.
That's when I realized that a month before, I had at my feet everything that was in front of me at the auction. There were two Renoir and several Ingres and Degas. When I realized the prices, I couldn't believe it. The famous books of Picasso and Chagall were sold for more than 800,000 francs at the time. That's how I came to like works of art, because everything that was sold was worth millions.
But here's the thing. Stealing art, it's not the same as selling art. Stolen masterpieces are like gold that happens to be radioactive. They seem valuable, but are actually dangerous and unsellable.
Jewels were the best choice. I could live off them and never be in jail. Really, I got into art personally. I like paintings the most. I had Degas, Renoir, Signac, Derain, Pissarro, Dubuffet, and many others. To sell them was dangerous, and I never had reliable sources abroad to flog them to collectors or receivers.
Tomich got caught sometimes. In fact, he spent nearly 15 years in prison. There was one guy, though, who Tomich could sell to reliably. His name was Jean-Michel Corvez, and he ran this small gallery right in the Bastille. Corvez was a middleman, so he had clients, and they had particular tastes. And those tastes were the basis of a kind of shopping list that he gave to Tomich. On this list, there was Basquiat, Chagall, Klimt, Pizarro, Monet. Oh, and Modigliani and Leger, they were on the list too. And they were also on the walls of the MAM when Tomich strolled through the museum. So after he spots these paintings, Tomich meets with Corvez. He tells him what he's seen, and Corvez says that he wants the Leger, a painting called Still Life with Candlestick. They haggled. Corvez would only pay 40,000 euros, which was less than Tomich wanted, and way less than the painting was worth. But in the end, Tomich gave in. The money was nice, of course. But for Tomich, he also just loved pulling off a clean heist. It's the early hours of May 20th. The streets are quiet. It's dark. Paris is asleep. And Tomich's window is ready. He's bought two suction cups that he attaches to the glass pane. And then he uses a crowbar to ever so gently pry the window from the frame.
There is also the seismic sound alarm on each. The slightest noise can trigger it. So I am very careful, especially when I move the window pane, which is very heavy. Behind the window pane, there is the grill, padlocked with a chain, which I have to open. It is not hard.
He slips into the museum and then leaves almost immediately. He goes back to the banks of the Seine, where he waits for 15 full minutes just to make sure no alarms have gone off in the museum. When it seems like the coast is clear, he climbs back through the window a second time. He takes the Leger off the wall and out of its frame. Now, this should be it. Mission accomplished. A clean job. But standing alone in the museum, in the dim light and the silence, a feeling overtakes him. That old irresistible pull. And he finds himself staring face to face with Matisse's pastoral of three nudes reclining in a verdant setting, while a fourth figure with dark red coloring plays a flute.
It's magical. Its colors and the paint that pops out a little in relief, thick, make a beautiful work. In this painting, I saw a deep, vivid nature, much more fertile than today. And the little devil playing his flute out of nowhere, as if by magic, as if he were the guardian of this environment where hostesses, guests join in on his alluring music. I love impressionists.
He grabs it, and a Modigliani, and then three more paintings. Then he spots another. It's Modigliani's Woman with Blue Eyes.
I will never forget what this woman with blue eyes did to me. When I went to get it off the wall, it told me, "If you take me, you will regret it for the rest of your life." I think when I touched it, to take it out of its frame, it started instantly. A fear that came over me, like an iceberg. A freezing fear. All the hair of my arms was stiff. I had to run away. That was it.
So he leaves the painting on the wall. He takes the others out of their frames and carries them to his car. And he sits there for 5 minutes, equivocating. I mean, he's so close to the museum, he could go back for more. The window, it's still accessible. It would be so easy. And like that, he's in motion again, crossing the street back towards the museum that he's just robbed. He's stepping over a small barrier when his pants rip. A car stops at a red light a few hundred feet away, and boom, reality sets in. The streets are empty, and here he is, next to the museum, wearing a hooded sweatshirt, looking very much like the thief that he is. He leaves, this time for good.
The evening at MAM could have been worse. Not for me, but for them. 5 was the limit. I saw the burglary of the 5 paintings from the MAM in my dreams, 15 years earlier. I knew that someday I would do something great.
More than $70 million worth of art stolen in one night. The 5 paintings were some of the most important in the museum's collection. Investigators said that the thief had a sophisticated knowledge of the works. At least, he had a good eye. The next morning, though, Tomic has a problem. Instead of one stolen painting on his hands, he has 5. When he meets the buyer, Corvez, he only gets paid for the Leger, the painting they'd agreed on. A shoebox filled with 40,000 euros in small bills. But Tomic gives all 5 paintings to Corvez. Corvez says he'll try to sell 3, no promises, but Tomic wants Matisse's pastoral for himself. He's just leery of having it on him right now. After all, he's a convicted art thief. He's got to lay low. Sure enough, the police start watching him. As their investigation points ever towards Tomic, they begin listening in on some of his phone calls. And when they actually call his phone, they get this surreal greeting.
If you want to buy paintings or works of art or exceptional jewelry, do not hesitate to contact me. Among the lot of paintings, there are also 5 that are extremely expensive, so we can discuss.
Tomich is so eager to sell the other paintings that he's actually advertising them to people who call. And he's bragging a bit, too. But the police, they need more than just an outrageous phone message to arrest Tomich. They need material evidence. About a year goes by, and Tomich needs money. But it's not just money he needs. He wants his Matisse back from Corvez. On the upside, you know, he's not in jail. And maybe even the MAM robbery will go unsolved, and he'll eventually get some money for the rest of the MAM paintings that he'd given to Corvez. But Tomich robs his other apartment, and he gets busted. This time he stole some watches and a Pizarro, and when the police search Tomich's apartment, they find the stolen jewelry, a bunch of watches, climbing equipment. They also found paintings, but not the ones from the MAM. When the police questioned him, Tomich confessed to the latest apartment robbery. But then the police tell him that just a couple of days earlier, they'd questioned Jean-Michel Corvez, too. And Tomich, he gets paranoid.
I could not believe it. Maybe he wanted me to go to jail, so he walks away. With people like Corvez, you will quickly rot in a very deep hole for the rest of your life.
He's totally worried that Corvez is going to pin the entire MAM job on him. Lie about the fact that it was Corvez himself who commissioned the robbery in the first place. Not just that. What if Corvez would get off and keep the paintings? Or worse yet, what if he'd already sold them without giving Tomich any money?
I had been waiting for a year. I thought, he had already sold all my works. It was a nightmare. The question is to know where the works really are right now.
Now, if Tomich confessed to his part and told them everything he knew about Corvez, maybe at least the police would find the art.
For me, the trial was the solution to make the paintings reappear. Maybe they are still alive, but well hidden.
At trial, Corvez said he'd passed them along to someone else, another middleman, who then testified that he'd panicked and thrown them into the trash. Yeah, the trash. In France, there's no penalty for lying on the stand. And Tomich doesn't believe that Corvez or the middleman told the truth. And I gotta wonder how honest Tomich was with me. He seemed to really love telling his story, but sometimes I felt like he was toying with me, just reveling in the mystery that he had in fact created. And sometimes he seems to think that whoever has the paintings will give them up.
One day or another, he will be forced to give them to the person to whom they belong. That is to say, me.
Jake Halperin is a contributor to The New Yorker, and the letters from Vieran Tomich were read for us by actor Jean Brassard. You're listening to The New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Denise Ho was big, really big, one of the major stars in the Cantonese pop music world of China. Ho played stadiums. She was in movies. She advertised Levi's, Lancôme, Yves Saint Laurent. Then she joined a political protest, the so-called Umbrella Protest of 2014, and now Beijing branded her poison.
You know, somehow at that point, having reached that, you know, so-called peak of awards and all that, I was starting to get onto that path of thinking, is that all? You know, is that all that I can do with my songs, my career, you know, just for personal wealth and all that. And so, yeah, that was when I started to think, you know, should I be doing more?
Denise Ho is now living in Hong Kong, trying to remake her career as a kind of counterculture songwriter, an activist for democracy and LGBT rights, all under the close scrutiny of the authorities. We'll talk with her next week on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Thank you very much, everybody. You know, 18 months ago, this was a field. And now it's one of the most advanced places of any kind you'll see anywhere in the world. It's incredible.
Last summer, Donald Trump was in Wisconsin to sing the praises of a deal that he had made with Terry Goh. Terry Goh is the chairman of the Taiwanese electronics maker Foxconn.
And I want to be thanking Terry Goh, chairman of Foxconn and a friend of mine, one of the most successful businessmen in the world. Very few people even close. And I want to thank him for investing in Wisconsin and investing in the United States.
Trump came to the White House promising voters in the Midwest and other industrial parts of the country that he'd reverse the trend of manufacturing jobs that have been going overseas for years. This is still a major theme of his trade wars. Recently, he was threatening Apple with tariffs on its phones, which are all made in China. So this Foxconn plant in Wisconsin was intended as a showpiece of the president's economic vision. How did it go so wrong? Dan Kaufman is a Wisconsin native who's been reporting on the state's political battles for years. He's the author of a new book called The Fall of Wisconsin. Here's Dan.
Racine, Wisconsin is an old manufacturing town. This is the home of the famous Johnson Wax headquarters, designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. Case tractors and Jacobson lawnmowers were made in Racine. Auto parts, Dremel tools, and the first garbage disposal, known as the incinerator. A quarter of the jobs are still in manufacturing, but that's way down from where it used to be, according to Racine's mayor, Corey Mason.
Still our biggest sector, but nowhere near the 85% of jobs that used to represent that sector. So we are a classic middle-class town that makes things, right? And certainly what I've heard from constituents in the 11, 12 years I've been knocking on doors and running for office is, when are we going to bring good middle-class jobs back to Racine? And just really this feeling that people in Wisconsin or Racine just can't make it if we don't make anything.
Corey Mason was a Democratic state representative when the deal to bring Foxconn to Racine came to the legislature, and he voted for it, even though that meant bucking his own party and siding with the Republican governor, Scott Walker, a Tea Party hero who Mason bitterly opposed.
My job is to see beyond that and look at what it means for residents here. There was nothing else this big that had this much investment that was going to come to our area, certainly in my lifetime. And so it would be a shame to let partisan politics trump that opportunity.
Foxconn manufactures most of our iPhones. Apple is its biggest client, but it also makes products for Microsoft, Nintendo, and Sony. You might remember some years back, in 2010, Foxconn had a notorious labor rights issue. Workers at a plant in China began committing suicide by throwing themselves off a high-rise company dormitory. Terry Goh, the chairman, responded by putting up safety nets to catch them. In Wisconsin, Foxconn's initial agreement with the state was to make enormous display panels for flat-screen TVs. This was going to be a state-of-the-art 21.5 million square foot facility, and it would employ up to 13,000 workers. Then we get to the fine print. State and local municipalities will be giving the company more than $4.5 billion. That's the largest subsidy for a foreign corporation in American history, and that works out to about $1,800 per household. And then there are the environmental issues. At Governor Walker's request, the EPA exempted most of southeastern Wisconsin from smog pollution limits. Foxconn is also exempt from state laws protecting wetlands, and the company can draw millions of gallons a day from Lake Michigan.
I don't want them getting $4.5 billion or any dollars, not a single dime. I want them to obey our wetlands laws and file an environmental impact statement.
Matt Flynn is a lawyer and the former chairman of the Wisconsin Democratic Party. he's been one of the most outspoken opponents of the Foxconn deal.
And I want the 7 million gallons a day that they want to take out of Lake Michigan reviewed under the Great Lakes Compact. I also do not want them having a waiver of the clean air requirements in southeastern Wisconsin, which they got. Now, Walker is basically adopting a Chinese communist business model. And once a fair amount of money is given to them, they're too big to fail. And what if they come in 5 years from now and say, now we have to go to a different model, but we need another $500 million.
But the Foxconn deal gets worse, actually. Earlier this year, Foxconn announced that it will no longer be building this large plant, but a much smaller one. It will be highly automated. Most of the assembly work will be done by robots. This plant needs only 3,000 workers, not 13,000, and nearly all of them will be knowledge workers, engineers, programmers, and designers. These are not going to be blue-collar jobs. On top of that, the Wall Street Journal has reported that Foxconn would be bringing engineers from China to fill some of these jobs, although the company denies this. One thing that got a lot of attention in Wisconsin was the use of eminent domain to take people's homes for the Foxconn plant.
I'll take you back to the entry area, the back entry.
I recently went to see Kim Mahoney and her husband, Jim. They grew up in the Racine area, and they spent years planning to build their dream house in nearby Mount Pleasant. Unfortunately, their plot is exactly where the Foxconn plant is going up. There's heavy construction equipment out of nearly every window.
We picked this floor plan because we love to entertain, especially for Packer games and Wisconsin Badger games. They said they're going to start this. I think they're actually building this road right now. I think that's what these bulldozers are doing. They're getting ready to build.
They're putting in the sewer.
All of their neighbors have sold their homes to the village, and almost all of them have been demolished already. Kim and Jim are the last holdouts.
They want to take our property and give it to Foxconn. They don't want to do anything else with it. They don't want it to be for a public road or utilities. But if they could have found a public use for taking our property, that's what they should have done. They want these properties for Foxconn because they've already promised to give them to them.
Stories about people losing their homes don't look good on the news. And the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, a nonpartisan state agency, said the project wouldn't pay for itself until 2042, at the earliest. Instead of a campaign talking point for Governor Scott Walker, Foxconn may have contributed to his defeat. Walker lost in November to Tony Evers, a Democrat who was very critical of the deal. But in early December, the Republican legislature pushed through several bills stripping the incoming governor of some of his power before Evers was sworn in. This became a huge national story. It's been compared to a coup. One of those bills took away the new governor's control over the agency that manages the state's dealings with Foxconn. The Speaker of the Assembly, Robin Voss, was pretty blunt about it.
We know that Tony Evers has said that he might go back and look at the Foxconn deal. Look, I represent the area where Foxconn is. I am not going to allow incoming Governor Evers to screw up the largest economic opportunity for the region that I represent in the state.
So if the governor no longer has the power to influence the Foxconn deal, Matt Flynn, the Democratic lawyer, may take it to court. He thinks that the contract violates the state's constitution.
I've identified a top-notch litigator with experience in a top-notch firm who has a draft of a complaint, and it would require some financial support. So, I mean, a lot of people are just very conservative on taxes, and they know this is going to come from somewhere. We're being played for suckers, and I just wanted to kick over the whole apple cart.
Wisconsinites are going to be paying for Foxconn for decades. The billions that are being taken away from the budget might have been used to pay for other jobs, like hiring more teachers or fixing the state's crumbling roads. Any way you look at it, you have to use magical thinking to think that Foxconn is worth it. So you might ask, why would the state make a deal like this? When Scott Walker first ran for governor, he said that tax cuts and deregulation would bring a boom to Wisconsin. He promised to create 250,000 jobs in his first term. But well into his second term, it was clear he wasn't going to get there. And his approval rating had fallen into the mid-30s. Walker became desperate to stay in the governor's mansion. And when he couldn't deliver enough jobs, he bought jobs at an astronomical cost. Here's a telling detail. In October, President Trump flew to Wisconsin for a Scott Walker rally, and he talked about walking through the Foxconn plant.
Anywhere in the United States, one of the most incredible things I've ever seen. One of the most incredible things. I'll never forget, I'm going around with Scott.
But there's the magical thinking. Because the Foxconn plant hasn't been built yet. What the president visited was a kind of temporary demonstration the company had set up in a warehouse. The electronics plant and the thousands of jobs it may one day offer is still just a construction site outside the Mahoney's window.
And you come back 3 months later, they have a whole robot factory made. It's the most incredible thing. This is truly one of the great plants, certainly in this country. I don't think there's anything close. And in the world, it's right at the top. And it was done because of Scott.
Dan Kaufman's recent book is called The Fall of Wisconsin. I'm David Remnick, and that's it for the New Yorker Radio Hour this week. Hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. Our team includes Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Terrence Bernardo, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.